Hail and well met. Welcome to another episode of Self-Evident. My name is Jenna, and today we have a very, very exciting episode today because we have three very extraordinary guests. We're going to be talking about the transgender issue, and we're going to be specifically focusing on how it has impacted society, not only in America, but across the world. So real quickly, would you guys like to introduce yourselves, who you are and what you do? Maya, let's start with you.
Hi, my name is Maya Poet. I'm 24 years old. And I started identifying as transgender at the age of 12 in 2012, so I was an early adopter. My parents did not affirm me, and I found myself in the Middle East, in Israel, where I lived undercover as a man for like 4 years and integrated myself within Palestinian Muslim and Orthodox Jewish communities living as a man. And it was really the experience of living through war that made me realize the impracticalities of transition. And so that caused me to give up on my childhood dream of becoming a man because I realized that it wasn't possible, that it was impractical and dangerous. And now I am here speaking out not only about this gender issue, but also about, you know, some extreme flaws that I see within Western discourse around Middle Eastern politics and the traps that I see the West falling into. I think somebody needs to save the West from itself.
And where can people reach you? Do you have a social media website?
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter or X as at thepeacepoet99. And I've also started a YouTube channel, which is at Maya Poet.
That's fantastic. Camille.
My name is Camille Kiefel. I am a detransitioner. I was struggling with childhood trauma, and because of that, I had a disconnect with being a girl, and I saw transition as an escape. And so in college, I was introduced to the idea of being non-binary, and after struggling with years of mental illness, not getting any reprieve from that, I sought transition, physical transition, as an answer. So yeah, so that's my story. I'm president of Detrans Help and helping other detransitioners get the resources they need and bringing awareness to this important issue.
And what is your website?
My personal website's CamilleKiefel.com. And then I also have Detrans Help, which is www.detranshelp.org.
That's fantastic. And people who have listened to Self-Evident before, we just had Camille on and we heard her story. So if you want to hear more in depth about her, please go listen to her episode. And now, Richie.
Hello, everyone. My name is Richie Heron. I'm 37 years old and I'm from the United Kingdom. I transitioned as an adult at the age of 26. By transition, I mean I took the hormone blockers and the estrogen, and then I had surgery in 2018. Pretty much, to cut a long story short, shouldn't have had that surgery. I found it impossible to have any real discussions around surgery or why we were identifying into transition. And then about 4 or 5 years of just being gaslit into silence, I just kind of was just like, you know what, I'm going to talk about this, and I don't care how many people say how wrong I am, I'm just going to say it because I'm sick of not being heard. And the reasons that I went into transition are the same as everyone else. I was just very isolated, I had very low self-esteem, and I found a lot of bad ideas online, and this was one of them. My whole point about my story is not just entertaining the fact that perhaps the surgery isn't as good as they say it is. I don't believe for 1 second a surgery that has a 1 in 6 chance of leaving you completely numb has a 99% satisfaction rate. The figures don't match up. And I want to give people a chance to say for themselves that this wasn't within my best interests. I have been misguided. It wasn't all on me. And it's to allow guys especially to have that conversation without the blame that comes with it, because it's a very different experience coming in this as an adult, yeah, who didn't transition as a child,
right,
and a male too. Like, those are two different dualities. And I've been speaking out for 2 years. You can find me on the social media app formerly known as Twitter on @tulip, that's TULLIPR, or you can just search my name, Richie Heron, with a T.
Fantastic. All right, guys, let's dive right into it. Maya, you know a lot about Israel. How does the transgender issue look in that country?
Israel is a really interesting country because it's a mixture of East and West. Like, it is a democracy, which separates it from the predominant political ideologies of the rest of the Middle East, but it's also highly religious and very ethnically and religiously diverse. And these religions coexist in peace. And so there's a certain plurality. And if there's anything we know about a pluralistic society, especially one where everybody has very strong convictions and everybody is unwilling to compromise in any of their convictions, is that sometimes there are social conflicts. And in a place like Israel, that plays out in a really interesting way, specifically in regards to the trans issue. So I think that what normalized transition, especially within the gay male community in Israel, was the win of Dana International, or he won Eurovision in 98. I believe, and this was like the first openly transsexual person to win Eurovision. This became sort of like a cultural icon for Israel. This, especially, like I've noticed talking to older gay men, when they describe the transgender phenomenon popping up within gay communities, it was really following this win of this particular person.
Wow, that is so interesting.
There's that element of it, but I would say that in Israel, the way this phenomenon is playing out, like especially the more modern iteration of this phenomenon, really, so I guess something important to know about Israel is that they really look up to the United States and they follow American trends, albeit with like a 10-year delay.
Interesting.
So I think that Israel got like color TVs for the first time probably in the 80s. So everything, like every American trend catches on with a 10-year delay, and this is no exception to that rule. The way that these treatments are covered, so basically, if you're under 18, none of these treatments, whether it's puberty blockers or cross-sex hormones or surgeries, are covered under the national health care, the national insurance. However, if you're willing to pay out of pocket, they'll do just about anything. And when it comes to adults, a lot of these treatments are covered. In fact, if the treatments are not performed in Israel, you can get your trip to go abroad to get these interventions done abroad, that you can get that paid for by your national health insurance, because it's, you know, considered to be necessary healthcare, because of course healthcare across the world in regards to this trans issue has been overwhelmingly captured by the likes of WPATH. That's the way that it's playing out medically. You see a lot of the same types of corruption. Like in Israel, it appears as if there are some safeguards, like the fact that the bureaucracy moves very slow, the fact that there are requirements for letters from psychiatrists. However, I've seen cases of detransitioners in Israel where even the psychiatrists refused to write a letter for this individual because they were too mentally unstable to consent to any kinds of these procedures. But then this person went to the doctor and said, "I only have one letter, so I don't know how we're going to do this." And the doctor was like, "Oh, we have an in-house psychiatrist."
Wow.
Who will write one for you. So this type of shoddy medicine and corrupt behavior is happening over there as well. And the kids who get into it in Israel are overwhelmingly secular. They're the secular English-speaking kids, because we know that these ideas travel in English. And then from then on, you know, the kids encounter these ideas on the internet in English, and they take these ideas to their in-person, you know, subcultural friend groups, and they hang out mostly in this mall in Tel Aviv, and they'll translate these ideas into Hebrew. And so this ideology is starting to spread much more within secular society. And then secondarily, the other cohort of people that tends to get into it are young adults or even slightly older adults who are gay and who come from religious backgrounds, whether they be Muslim or Orthodox Jewish. And they have so much shame around being gay, and they go to a gay youth organization seeking help with homophobia and with how to deal with leaving an all-encompassing religious community that used to meet all of their needs. They go into a gay youth organization, and these ideas are immediately pushed on them. Like, they'll come in not related to trans in any way, and then they'll sit down in a support group and everybody's asked their pronouns. So this idea is pushed, and it's very alluring to somebody who is gay and comes from a religious environment, because they feel so much shame and they just think, well, wouldn't it be easier for me to assume the opposite sex role? Because then, you know, if I were to successfully pass as a member of the opposite sex, I would get so much less flack for being gay. So that's sort of the way it's playing out over there.
That is so fascinating. What about the overall in Israel, the cultural norm? Is it widely accepted?
I would not say it's widely accepted. I mean, the thing about Israeli society is that it's so sectarian, it's so divided. Like, you have religious Jews and secular Jews, and of course there are gradations within religious Jews. And then with the Arabs, you have like Christian Arabs, you have Muslim Arabs, you also have Druze. And overwhelmingly, it's still a very religious and conservative country, but gotcha. Especially in Tel Aviv and in sort of secular communities, I think people are much more willing to accept it. It's not totally accepted, I think, within secular society, but
It's creeping in.
Yeah, it's creeping in, exactly. Like, it's probably the way that the United States was maybe, 10 years ago.
Gotcha. Interesting. And so, Camille, you have had an experience in Oregon, right? That's where your battle hole is taking place. What have you seen, and what are your insights in the American world, like in culturally, how is this affecting America?
Yeah, it's impacting America in a couple different way, or in a few different ways. So I studied women's studies back in like 2010.
Okay.
So I was getting like what's going on right now, like that was happening back then in the universities.
Yeah.
But it hadn't hit yet. So
it was all kind of more like theory.
It was more theory, and that theory hadn't been exported, I want to say, into different parts of society and different systems. And how they were teaching it was that you would go and you would almost educate. And that was kind of the thing. Another way would be to infiltrate systems, like schools and stuff like that. Like, that would be more of a militant term, but they don't like militant terms. So there's sort of like, even though a spade's a spade, they have different ways of wording it. So they like talk about
Yeah, who controls the dictionary controls the world. That
right.
makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. And so they'd be like, well, you can go into the video game industry and then you can go and educate, your teams or whatever, or like work into the stories. And we're actually seeing that right now
wow.
in video games and stuff like that. So that's what they would actually teach you to do in these classrooms.
This is how you normalize it.
Yeah, and it normalize it. And I think that there's like something very human about wanting to improve things and improve the lives of people.
Yeah.
And other individuals who are struggling. But the way it's done is so militant. And it's interesting because even in those classrooms, like I just remember talking to a professor and she had issues with how dogmatic it was. So even within these circles, like they know that there's an issue, but they're too afraid to speak up.
Mm.
So even within those cultures, like even if they know an issue, but there are real consequences of things such as call-out culture. You get ostracized and you don't want to do that, even though you know that this dogmatic nature is an issue. It was interesting seeing that. And I said this yesterday on the panel, but one of the best things a therapist ever said to me was, Camille, you're digging the hole wider, but you're not digging yourself out of it. And a lot of people are struggling and they're searching for meaning. They're searching for reprieve from depression, anxiety, like they're struggling.
Yeah.
And so something like critical theory can look very appealing. Like, it's not your fault, especially like if you have been blamed, like I struggle with ADHD and, people do treat you differently for that. And it's just like, it's like, I tried my best, but I was, I'm like, my papers are everywhere. Like I can't stay organized in school. And it's like, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? And then here's this, this theory that's saying like, no, it's actually not you. It's everyone else. And I think that's the problem, is that it becomes the opposite of you're blaming everybody else when it's like this messy thing of life.
You're never the problem.
Yeah. So you're not the problem. It's everybody else. And so that can be very appealing to somebody who's really struggling. Why this can be appealing too is that because we're seeing this a lot in neurodivergence. So I'll start with the popular one is autism. Like, therapists really like autism. Like, it's kind of weird. Like, I've had so many therapists and they're all like giddy and they're like, has anybody ever talked to you that you might be autistic? And I'm like, it's just weird. Like, it happened 3 times. I'm like, okay, this is kind of weird. Like, why are you excited about this? But so there's like this almost excitement that therapists have about autism. And it's weird because the thing is that people were picking up on these autistic traits I had, but they were also traits with ADHD. And so what I really have is ADHD. It's just they're similar traits that overlap. And so thing is, what worries me about this whole gender thing is that there's a lot of discussion around autism, but there's going to be ADHD kids and adults who are going to be missed out on and like overlooked because around this whole gender ideology, because it's not the popular topic. And so there was a study that found with gender variance, someone who's autistic is 7 times more likely to be gender variant.
Wow.
With ADHD, it's 6. So it's really shortly behind. I mean, there's more neurodivergent a part of that, but just because there is such an overlap, I do worry about that not being discussed. And in general, we do need to discuss more of the neurodivergence in general with that. Also, there's just not a lot of like focus in on neurodivergence. And so you have kids and adults who are struggling. There's like this escapism and there's this maybe even self-loathing. And then there's all this other critical theory that's telling them that they're privileged or whatnot. And they're struggling. It's like, why am I struggling? I'm privileged or whatnot. And so I think that they're thinking that it's a trans thing when it's like, no, you're actually struggling with neurodivergence and it's okay to be neurodivergent. Like, you're not a bad person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen that in Israel or in the UK? Have you heard this topic being discussed about autism. The neurodivergence and the autism?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's always been said passively that if you're autistic, you, I think it was like 1 in 20 autistic people are gender, like, variant or whatever. Whereas in the general population, it was like 1 in 100. So it was like this huge, it's always been known. But yeah, what was the original question that you asked the other two?
The original question I wanted to ask you guys is, what is it like culturally in your country?
The whole transgender
issue. Yeah.
It's, I think the takeaway that I would really want people to understand is, what happens in an individual country or district or county is very much the effect but not the cause. It's just, it will play out differently in different places, but it's not the root cause. The root cause is the internet that spread this idea. It spread it like wildfire on social media too. And it's all about, you've got this group of people who are very isolated, with low self-esteem, who get this movement that comes with an instruction manual, not only on how to socialize, but what your worth and value is too. But the vast majority of people who go into transition are very isolated people, and the internet brings people together. And I think that is the main factor. I think what happens on the ground is just the effect of that cause.
The plant will look different in different places, but it's going to be the same problem.
Exactly.
We're part of Generation Z, this podcast, and people listening might have a brother or a friend that is really struggling with the idea that they are actually the opposite sex. What would you guys say to that sibling, that friend who is watching their loved one go through that? How can we help our friend or our relative?
When you say help, what do you mean by that?
Well, be able to be there for them, be able to help them realize that a surgery is not the way to escape their problems, basically.
So, I suppose what you're saying is try to convince them off the path. I think it's very key to understand that when somebody is on a strict pathway to this and they believe in it, if you come in with resistance, you're not seen as an ally, you're seen as an enemy. And I think people need to understand that some people who are in it can't be talked out of it. The only thing that you can really do is, rather than showing that concern, because what you often find is the people who are concerned for the individual, they're more concerned about their own worry in some regards, which is a very natural human thing to do. But you can't talk people who are dead set on it out of it without looking like an asshole, to be honest. The only thing out would ever suggest doing to those people is just being like, so I guess you've seen people who haven't had a good turnout as well as the good ones. Ask them very open-ended questions, like, what did you find out about the people who it worked for versus the people who it didn't? What was, like, the main difference? And you'll find, like, they go, oh, wait, you know, I haven't actually done that, or I don't really know. And I suppose giving them the chance to go find the information rather than spoon-feed it.
So just plant pebbles in their shoes then?
Kind of, but you have to also understand that what you want, that they're viewing that you want them not to go through this because you view it as harm, but they see it as you want something counter to what they want,
right.
And they're already engaged.
Right.
So they're like, well, what's it got to do with you and stuff like that? And I think you need to break down, you need to get past the surgery topic and be like, hey, you're my friend. I'm worried you're going to get hurt from this. This is why I think you're going to get hurt from this. And taking away the the topic of surgery and trans and all that sort of thing, it's like, I've been reading stories about people who have had horrific symptoms from this.
Yeah.
There's something seriously concerning about that. You're my good friend. I don't want you to be hurt. And I think you can reduce it at that basic level. But if you bring this up as a topic of the surgery itself, like trans ideology or whatever, right, you're going to push them away massively.
That makes sense. Thank you. Camille, Maya, would you guys have anything to add to that?
Yeah, what Richie said about the open-ended questions I think is perfect. Yeah, because I know personally, like, my stepmom had asked me a question and it made me rethink things. So, like, it was more like a critical gender thing anyway. Yeah. So it wasn't necessarily on the trans topic, but it was something like, oh, okay, like, I didn't actually mean that. So I've had personal experience with that. So it's like, that can be very helpful, but it's almost like deprogramming. So that's what makes it very difficult, is that you're right, dealing with an ideology and somebody who in a belief system. It's like, you know, working someone away from that is just, it's going to take a lot of time. It's going to take questions. And then two, if you don't have their trust, then that becomes an issue too. If they like catch on, they're like, oh, well, you just want me to get away from this.
Yeah, follow your line for my life or whatever.
It's really tricky. There's not like a really good, easy answer for that.
Right.
It just,
no one, like, size fits all.
Right. And so, yeah, yeah, and also like what you're saying, kind of like if somebody was like, hey, I'm concerned about this, like that can be a potential too. Like I wish somebody had done that with me. Like I also wish somebody had talked to me about detransition, because nobody ever brought up that there's such a thing as detransitioners and what the commonalities were amongst detransitioners. So
can I just also add in that, Camille, that sometimes hearing it from the individual themselves is a lot more powerful than hearing it from somebody who's concerned, even if you are a close friend, because they view you as not having any authority if you don't have this experience. Whereas someone like me or anyone else in my position, it's very hard to argue against, because I've lived that and I've been through that. So it's different in that way, but not everyone has the contact that they can fall on. And it's obviously not our job to save everyone, you know?
When I think about how do I answer your question, I like to think about myself at the age of 12 when I got into this whole topic. My story's a little bit different, because especially for somebody of my generation, because I didn't have this peer-to-peer influence. I actually sought out the concept of a sex change because I knew that it applied to men. I knew that there were some men who tried to become women, and I just didn't realize that I was gay. I was pretty confused by all these crushes I was having. I mean, I thought crush was an orange soda that my peer group was obsessed with. And I thought that all the feelings that I was feeling in my body, all these physical sensations, you know, I looked them up on WebMD because they confused me. And I got the results back of like three possible neurodegenerative disorders. So I thought I was like gonna die. So I was pretty distressed by that alone. Like, I think it's different when you get into it as a kid. If you're dealing with a kid, it's a different, you know, scenario than if you're dealing with an adult. Right. But if you're dealing with an adult who got into this as a kid, that becomes a much more complicated thing to deal with, especially in my case. Like, I invested half of my life into this dream, into thinking that this was going to solve all my problems. What I really wanted deeply was normalcy, because I got so much flack for you know, my sense of style. Like, I love to wear vests and bow ties, and I was given the message that that was unacceptable for a woman to do and even disgusting. So definitely, I think that if you're dealing with somebody who is gay and who is dealing with some kind of internalized homophobia, what would have really helped me was if I had met some older lesbians who weren't woke and who said, hey, like, there are a lot of lesbians within the last few decades who have taken this path, who've transitioned, and it's a complicated path. They don't become men. They just get alienated from their lesbian communities, and then they feel even more alone. Like, that's the thought that I've heard expressed many times from lesbians that I'm now talking to at this point in my life, and I would have really wanted to hear that. But I think that, you know, in general, we're, like, to take it away from the topic of if you have like a gay teen or adult who is dealing with, you know, these doubts about their gender, and we just take it more broadly to something that could apply to anybody. You know, Richie and Camille have talked about asking kind of open-ended questions, and I want to add to that and say that, you know, you have to be pretty mindful about which specific questions you ask, because like, even though I got into trans in a very like analytical way, like I reasoned my way into trans and I reasoned my way out of it, which was a little bit different. So my story might be a little bit different in that regard. If you are dealing with somebody who is more typical and who didn't necessarily reason their way into trans and, you know, come to it as like a sort of rational coping mechanism based on all the information they had at the time, albeit the information is flawed and based on lies and logical obfuscations, namely the premise that you can change sex, which as mammals we can't do, and then the lies just, you know, skyrocket and snowball from there. But when we're talking about trying to craft the right question to ask somebody who's identifying as trans to sort of allow them to process maybe doubts that they have, because the trans community has all kinds of words to mask doubt. Like, for example, internalized transphobia. That's a classic one. If you want to put a little seed of doubt, maybe, you know, not I guess explicitly, but rather a little bit more implicitly, I wouldn't ask questions like, what makes you think you're a boy or what makes you think you're a girl? Because that person is latched onto, they've built a sense of self on a false premise, and they're not going to be receptive to you trying to dispute the assumptions upon the, you know, of their false premise. What I think is a little bit better is questions like the one that Richie had suggested earlier, like what separates those who regret it versus those who don't. I think that if you ask questions that allow somebody to be more analytical and to take it out of the realm of emotions, because emotions, they do inform our logical reasoning. However, when emotions are incredibly heightened, they impede our ability to reason logically and to be receptive to reason, which is really what we should be making our decisions with, is our reason, rather than just like irrational emotions. So I think that if you can maybe distance the topic a little bit, like if you can distance, you know, instead of saying, I'm worried that, you know, you are going to undertake X, Y, and Z procedures, which have X, Y, and Z complications, I think that you should just talk about the procedures and the complications. Like, I think that the conversation, like, for, and this might not work for everybody, but for me, that's what did it. For me, it was realizing that this path that I'd staked my entire life on, starting at the age of 12, and going so far as to move to the Middle East in order to be able to achieve it. I think that one of the best, what really helped me was realizing not only that there was such a thing as gender ideology, because I kind of wasn't super involved in the trans community. Like, I was kind of a lone wolf trans. Like, I just hung out with like Arabs and Jews who didn't know that I was actually female, and just lived my life undercover. I never wanted anybody to know I was trans. Like, that, the goal of my life was, again, it was normalcy. It was not to be different. It was just to assimilate within society. And so I think that, you know, for somebody like me, it was the only thing that made me realize that I shouldn't take this path was really actually meeting these two. I met them in Ireland a year ago. I've only, you know, desisted within the last year. And these two played like a pretty foundational role in that, because you see the fact that the true complications of these treatments are being hidden. Also just realizing the impracticalities of being tied to pharmaceutical industries when you live in a country that's super prone to war really just made me realize how much of a first world phenomenon this is. And I think that it's important for this friend or this person in your life who's struggling with gender issues, if you can play any role in sort of detaching the conversation from the personal and making it analytical, I think that, like, I don't know if this would work for everybody, but for somebody like me, it works.
Sorry, I kind of fundamentally disagree, because I think that a lot of people over-intellectualize a lot of things post and pre-transition, how they felt and how they feel, which is why you can never really have a conversation with anyone, no matter how right you are, because they'll revert to this anger, because it all comes back to that unbridled, untreat sort of, you're attacking me almost. It's like a vulnerability. And also, I really do think there's something malicious about planting seeds of doubt into people, because that's a very uncomfortable thing to do to someone. No matter, even if you're doing it from the perspective of harm reduction, it, in my opinion, to get somebody to start doubting themselves in my opinion, has a counter impact. It has the potential to get them far, far deeper, because these are people who are running away from very strong emotions, who want to find the logical and right reason to run away from them. And I think it all depends on the individual, to be honest, Maya. Like, some people might benefit from the over analytical, but that never helped me in all the years that I was trans identified for like 8-9 years. And not once, no matter how many times I thought about it, I was just thinking about how can I be right, not is this right, how can I be right? And that was of the fundamental vulnerability of I don't want to be weak, and I don't like this idea of doubt. And I think the doubt itself was something that I was experiencing naturally, that I was trying to explain to people, actually have doubts. And then they would say, no, you don't. That was when I was like, oh God, this is bad. But I do think that doubt has to kind of come from the individual themselves. They have to have the ability to go out and explore that, because again, we have this premise that, and I know this may sound controversial here, but we are deciding for them what's best for them, because it could be that some people simply do function better in their trans identity. And that may be a very hard pill for people to swallow. They may be way more productive as people, may way more sociable, way more put together. May not be the case for the majority, but we're all deciding that we need to plant out. That to me feels malicious. I know we're not wanting it to be, but I don't like that view in itself, because when you're trying to apply doubt into somebody, that never works in a positive way. It has to be something you receive from them. But if you want to entertain, do they know the knowledge? That's one thing. It's like, what do you know about the surgery, by the way? Because I've looked into it. I'm just wondering, what do you know? Not, I've got an opinion that this is wrong.
Right.
I'm just wondering, what do you know? That can be helpful. But otherwise, I think you run the risk of running them in deeper.
That makes sense. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I think that what you're saying is really important. I think that different approaches work for different people.
So it depends on the individual.
It depends on the individual. And I think it's kind of hard for most people to figure out, like, which approach do I use with which type of individual? I think it's hard to determine that because we're all in uncharted territory. Like, for example, my parents would say to me, like, oh, you're never going to pass as a man. Like, why would you even attempt this? And I just thought, oh, I'll show you. And so I went to a part of the world where nobody knows what a lesbian is, you know? I mean, in Tel Aviv they do, but I wasn't in Tel Aviv for that specific reason, you know, because I wanted to live my life as a guy. The lengths I went to, you know, to go all the way across the world to a country where it would be really easy for me to just assimilate as a man, like that's what I did. And the only thing, like, there were really only a few factors that snapped me out of it. One of which was living through war and having this thought go through my mind. Like, one time I just didn't make it to a bomb shelter in time when we were getting rockets, and I hid under a tree and I just looked up and I saw three rockets like rip through the air. It was terrifying. And I just thought, wow, I really massively failed at getting myself to the bomb shelter this time. And as the siren was blaring, I just kind of had like a almost a vision in my head, or like a thought of like, what would happen if right now I'm in a hospital recovering from an elective double mastectomy and I can't raise my hands above my shoulders and I hear a siren and I can't run to the bomb shelter? Like, what would come of me then? And so I think that the advice I give probably isn't applicable to most people, because most people, you know, they come into a trans identity in a safe first world country, albeit, you know, usually from factors which are traumatic, but are not related to specifically traumas of necessarily life and death, although that can happen sometimes. But I think that, you know, it's very possible that Richie's advice might be better for the average like Western listener. But I come from somewhere sort of a different cultural background, like a post-Soviet Jewish background. And because I was raised in like a highly intellectual tradition where we don't really do emotions in my family, we have very extremely intellectually stimulating conversations that are fascinating. But, you know, one of my blind spots, well, part of it's my age that I'm 24, but part of it is just that I'm not the most like emotionally in tune individual. I've had some crazy things happen to me, and I totally over intellectualize them, because that's the only way you can really deal with all all kinds of, you know, the psychological weight of all of these issues, whether it be, you know, surviving terrorist attacks on multiple occasions, including October 7th, or whether it be, you know, surviving half a lifetime of gender lies and realizing that this path that I'd staked my entire future on was built on fundamentally false premises. Like, in order for me to get out of the sort of pain and the grief, not only like the loss of my friends in war, but also the loss of my own sort of delusional ideas, and the loss of my trans fantasy, it required me to reason myself out of it. Like, there's no other way I would have been able to do it. And there are tons of people who give advice. I would say that probably Richie's advice is much better. Richie's and Camille's advice is probably better for your average, like, you know, Western listener or audience. But I mean, I think that if you have a highly analytical person like me, you know, it's trial and error. I think you have to try different strategies. And that's
why I wanted to have all of you guys on, because we get to hear different perspectives and different sides of things that now people can have that information and be like, I know my loved one the best. I would love to be able to try and help them using either intellect and analytics or just doing the open-ended questions. So thank you guys. This was awesome. I would love to continue, but we're kind of running out of time. I could talk with you guys for hours. I have so many questions for you, but maybe one day we can do some other interviews in another time. But thank you guys so much for coming on and giving us just a little taste of your opinions about what's going on in the world. And until we meet again, thank you so much for listening. Let us firmly rely on the protection of divine providence. This is Self-Evident.